have inspiring conversations with remarkable working women. And I am really excited today to have my friend Emily Allen from Digiday joining us. Emily, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's nice to have you. So let's start, please, by just learning a little bit about your career path up until the time you went to Digiday, because you have quite an impressive resume.
Oh, thank you so much. Okay, so I don't want to go back too far because I'm old. I've been around for a while.
We're the same age, actually. I think we've agreed that you're a year younger than me.
Which I don't know why we even go back to age, because it doesn't really matter. Anyways, I've always been a news junkie. My first job at college was at a newspaper in Los Angeles in the early 90s. And then the internet started. So I moved back up to San Francisco and found myself in an advertising role at a company, at a startup in San Francisco. To advance my career, because I was super ambitious, I quickly moved to New York City, where all of the publishers and agencies and brands tended to be. So I ended up at Time Inc. And then in a variety of roles at Time Inc. And then Smithsonian. I brought their print publications to digital and launched their travel website. Then I ended up at my favorite job, I think, in my entire career, was at Business Insider. I was asked to join their team as the first person on the business side. At that point, BI was for independent blogs with a very small audience. So over the course of 7 years, I grew the monetization and, you know, the advertising revenue. I ended up with probably 5 different departments over the course of my tenure there. I saw it through its acquisition from Axel Springer, and stayed a little bit after that, and then hopped over to iHeartMedia. I thought I'd give entertainment news a shot. So I went to iHeart, and at iHeart, I had oversight of the national editorial team, the national social team, all 850 local radio station news sites, as well as the digital marketing and sales development team. That was a really big role. Met a lot of interesting characters and artists, and got burnt out. Took a step back. Went back to news. I was at Axios for a little bit and then Recount Media during the presidential election in 2016, which was an interesting time. And then thought I'd try my hand on the agency side. I went to a performance marketing agency. I ran an 80-person team over there and then left New York City and found my dream job at Digiday.
Well, before we talk about your dream job at Digiday, working amongst a lot of amazing people, including our friend Jim Cooper, I want to talk to you about your career prior to that. Those kind of really big roles that you had, there's a lot of pressure being in those kind of roles, pressure to perform. And also, I would imagine, knowing you and knowing you as somewhat of a type A person, pressure that you put on yourself. Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah. I'm probably my own worst critic.
How do you handle that kind of pressure?
Well, you know, you being very sensitive to failure. I don't know, you know, why I'm that way, but I was certainly very sensitive to making sure that I was advancing in my career and had very good performance, a level of performance in each of my roles. Certainly there's, in my particular roles, I was on the business side. So at the end of the day, I was measured on my performance as it related to revenue. And, you know, the success of the business is always tied to revenue, right? Any growth of the business is dependent on how much money my team could generate. So that's a lot of pressure as well.
That's a lot of pressure. What was your definition of success? Not the business success in terms of the revenue, but what was your definition of your own personal success at the time?
So in the early days, my definition of success was career advancement, and that meant title changes, right? Was my title going up into the right, if you will. My measure of success was sometimes how many departments I ran or what was the number of total staff I oversaw, right? And these aren't always good measures of success. But at the time, it was my measure, right?
So how has it changed?
Well, you know, after a certain number of years, you figure out, and some people figure it out earlier than others, but, you know, after about 20 years, I figured out that that doesn't define me or my success. I've had a, you know, 24-year career in this industry, and now I measure my success through the experiences I've had, the friends I've made in the industry, long, you know, lifetime friendships. Have I been a good boss? Have I mentored people coming up behind me? Have I been a good advocate for change? Those are the things that are important to me now, but I didn't always think about in the early days.
Yeah. You know, I remember I saw an assistant that I used to have many, many years later. And I was really excited to see her. We were meeting up for a drink, and she said to me, "I want to thank you so much for everything that you taught me. And you were, you know, so such a hard boss, but so great." And I felt great about that. And then she said to me, it pretty much made it worth it that you made me cry every day. And I was like, what? But yeah, I pretty much cried every day when I worked for you. And I thought back, and I was very, not mean, but harsh, because I had such high standards for myself, which I still do. And I had such high standards for her and for all the people that work for me. And I'm not sure, ironically, being in communications, that I communicated them correctly. And certainly to hear that I made someone cry every day makes me sick to my stomach.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I've been told that I was sometimes scary, right? I'm a hard negotiator, but I'm also, yeah. I mean, you hold high if you hold high expectations for yourself, you certainly will hold high expectations for those around you.
So you mentioned you moved out of the city. You decided to make a conscious effort to switch gears and also took the job at Digiday, which we're going to talk about. Is this switching gears and being more aware what you expected?
Yes. So both of my kids are in college now. One of the hardest things, I guess, about my early career is being a good mom, right? That balance between being a present parent and being present for yourself and your own purpose, right? I stayed in New York. I was dedicated to the career and up until the time my kids left. And then, you know, once you get to a certain point, the title doesn't matter anymore, right? And the commute to Manhattan doesn't drive you anymore. It just, you know, I just, at a certain point, I think at year 20, you know, when they were just finishing high school and going into college, I finally realized that I could focus on me and what makes me happy. And, you know, I gave it a lot of thought, and I wanted to go back west. I grew up in the west, in the Sierras. I started my career in San Francisco. And I told my children, I was very clear, you go to college, I'm leaving. Right? And so obviously I still have college to pay for. So I still needed to work. I wasn't ready to retire. So I wanted to find a role that supported, was supportive of a move, right? A remote position, because not a lot of advertising and media roles in Colorado these days, but also that supported where I was in my career, right? I mean, DigitAid knows, they knew I was overqualified for this particular role, but I was very clear that I didn't want a big team. I'm happy being an individual contributor. I thought that my network was obviously going to be extremely valuable to DigitAid. And DigitAid, and I love Nick Breeze and I love DigitAid. And I think I've always relied on DigitAid over the course of my career as a publisher that educated people in my industry, right? That keeps people informed. It was always a good tool for me. So it was kind of a no-brainer when the role presented itself. I jumped at it.
I love it. So that's where I met you. And
yeah.
Please tell me, because you did get to do some really fantastic stuff there.
I do.
Tell us a little bit about your role there.
Okay. So my role is on the editorial side of the house, which is a bit of a jump from the business side. I work with the three editors at DigitAid to program their events. So I lead the content development and the speaker sourcing for their series of events. And the events range from, publishers to programmatic to media buying to work life, which is one of DigitAid's properties. So I'm currently sourcing people ops leaders. Yeah, so for a work life event.
So let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
What are the topics that are most, so that was like sort of broad, but what are some of the topics for upcoming conferences? Is anybody talking about anything that doesn't have to do with AI?
Yes.
Or no?
Yes. Yes. I work with the editors very closely on what are the overall themes for each of the events. What's going to resonate the most with people, with the attendees in particular, right? Who are the speakers that are really going to add value in the short time that we have with them? Some of the topics we're thinking about right now, in addition to AI and generative AI, some of the big topics are, the rise of the creator, right? Data, privacy, regulation, responsible and ethical media investment. And then, of course, AI and generative AI are the topics as well. The retail media, for example, is becoming a bigger part of the investment. We're dedicating an entire conference, their day in New York City, to the rise of retail media networks. So I'm working with a lot of brands, a lot of e-commerce or heads of digital investments on topics like that.
So as a PR person, I have to ask, because we have your ear right now, what do you look for in a great pitch for one of your conferences?
Good question. I look for a number of things, of course, but when I program each of the events, I'm really looking for a diversification of thought. First and foremost, seniority level is certainly important, but that person also needs to live in the weeds and really do that particular topic. We're not looking for a high level of thought. We're looking for a really meaningful conversation so our attendees leave the event with actionable insights and tools. Those are the biggest things I look for when I'm sourcing speakers.
And do you like to be, will you take a long pitch? Will you take a long pitch? Do you prefer a shorter one? Does it have to have a brand in it? Any other little things before we move on?
You know, shorter pitches are good. For me, there's, you know, I'm currently working on 6 events through the second half of the year. So there's a lot of moving parts. I mean, that is about 80 different people that I'm looking at right now for those events, just in 6 months. I'm also sourcing senior level executives for a number of other Digiday events like CAN, the ANAs, New Mexico. We do sponsored dinners at events. I work with the editorial team to source speakers for interviews at times. There's a lot going on. It's, you know, and the people that I look for are across brands and agencies, publishers. There's a finite number of publishers out there. So we're really looking for the people. The hottest topic, we have 2 publishing summits, for example, in a year, 2 programmatic summits, 2 media buying summits. So what the big topics are in the first half of the year compared to the second half of the year, we have to be mindful of making sure that both of those events are as diverse as possible in terms of topics and speakers as well. So it's hundreds and hundreds of people being sourced in any given year.
We talked about pressure a little bit earlier on. I mean, you might not have 80 people reporting to you or, you know, responsible for revenue across an organization. However, what you're talking about, even with this job, as any good and interesting job, I would assume there's still a lot of pressure. So have you figured out ways now at this point in your life that you deal better or differently with just the pressure of working?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm always living in the high performer area, right? So I've been at Digiday for less than a year. So one thing I'm still working on is work-life balance. Even though I'm in Evergreen, Colorado, I'm working remote. I look at pine trees and mountains out my window instead of skyscrapers. You know, I still have to be mindful of creating the balance. I'm also working 2 hours behind New York City, so I tend to be up really early. I'm at my desk by 7 a.m., but then I take a break. You know, New York slows down and I don't have 13 meetings a day anymore like I used to. So I take mindful breaks. I'll take my dog on a walk around the lake, for example. I'll take a hike with a friend. I'll, you know, talk to my mom. You have to be, you know, it's still a little difficult for me to not have a seat at the table, if you will. Mm-hmm. That's something I'm still learning to work with, but it's okay not to be privy to everything that goes on in the business, because this was a conscious choice. And my goal right now is to source, you know, the best speakers I can to be as efficient as possible, and to raise the bar at Digiday. I mean, it's a great brand. I think the events are great. But I think this year they've been open to new perspective and new thoughts. And, you know, right now we're really working on how do we future-proof the business.
Yeah.
In particular, the events business. So I still get to scratch that itch, right, with my role at Digiday. And I really want this business, you know, to be around for the next 1 or 2 generations of, you know, advertising and marketing leaders.
Well, if someone has a pitch for you or a good idea for a speaker, can they get in touch?
Yeah, absolutely. Emily at Digiday.
Excellent. So you talked about this conscious effort that you've made to sort of switch gears. And I'm curious, do you have any advice for other women out there who might want to do the same thing, but are either scared or not quite sure how to do it?
I think you'll know when you're ready. It comes, I assume, I expect it comes at different times. I mean, I had a certain timeline in my mind, but I would just encourage women, type A women, professionals, you know, ambitious people to just be authentic to themselves, to be mindful of their own personal well-being. It's okay to let go and acknowledge that it's okay sometimes to let go of your ego. I think a large part of what drove me professionally was my ego. I'm still working on letting that go a little bit, but I imagine it'll become easier. And just be kind and authentic. You'll always be okay. This is a great industry. Let go.
Well, to
you
add
have to let go.
First of all, the whole thing around ego, that's a whole, so we're going to need to do a part two for that one.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Something I think about a lot for myself, but just to build on the advice as my last question, mm-hmm. is there one piece of advice that has really helped you through your life and your career that you could please share with us?
I think the one piece of advice I'd like to share, or I would share, would be to be authentic to yourself, to know your worth, know your boundaries, know and understand when it's okay to focus on perhaps your happiness and your own well-being. But like I said before, it comes at different times for people. It's just, you know, I've had a great career and I'm very proud of what I've been able to accomplish and my contributions to the industry. I'm super proud of my network. But it was time for me to slow down.
Well, you've done amazing and you are doing amazing.
Thank you.
I want to thank you so much. Thank you, Emily.
Of course. Thank you.